The topic that was suggested is how to try to develop ourselves to become, I think the phrase that was conveyed was deeper people, to live with a depth. So I just wanted to share a couple of maybe random thoughts, not anything not anything less comprehensive. We know that Chazal speak of Shnei Yitzharim, on the most basic level, Yitzhar Tov means that we have a capacity and attraction to Dvarim Ruchaniyim, Dvarim Sichliyim, spiritual, intellectual matters. And the Yetzer Hara is that we have an attraction, an impulse for Dvarim Gufaniyim, for physical pleasures, for physical involvement. A fundamental distinction between how those respective Yitzharim function emerges from the Mesilas Yesharim HaKdama. So I'll just read you, or maybe a couple of lines from the HaKdama. So famously, Ramchal begins by saying that likely that the one who's learning his sefer won't find too many chidushim, and therefore the purpose of the sefer is not to learn through it once, but to learn again and again to serve as a reminder. And he says it as follows. He says, "Ein ha-to'elas ha-nilkot mizeh ha-sefer." The purpose which can be achieved from this sefer, from Maseiras Yesharim, yotzei min hakriya bo pam. It won't emerge from learning the sefer once. Ki kva efshe shel yimtza hakoy b'sichlo chidushim ach hakriya asa shelo hoyu bo lefnei kriya asa lama. It's entirely likely that you won't find any chidushim here. Aval hatoelas yotzei min hachazara ala v'hahasmada. The purpose will be achieved by constantly reviewing and constantly reinforcing. Ki yizachu lo, here comes the crucial sentence, I will say. Ki yizachu lo hadvarim ha'ela hanishkochem mibnei ha'odom b'teva. Because a person will be thereby reminded of Inyane Chasidus, Inyane Avodas Hashem, here's the phrase, Hanishkochem mibnei ha'odom b'teva, which a person otherwise naturally forgets. So what we think of, again, we have a Yetzer Tov, a Yetzer Hara. So we sort of think of, if I'm neutral, okay, so I'll be equally affected by my Yetzer Tov and my Yetzer Hara. Okay. Really, I should align myself with the Yetzer HaTov, but if I'll take a stance of neutrality, so then I'll sort of be pulled equally in both directions. So Chazal says that's not the case. And one more quote here. Re'eh, understand, ki ein divrei hachasidus ve'inyanei hayira va'ahava v'tahara salev. Matters of chasidus, yiras Hashem, avas Hashem, the purity of mind and heart, these are not dvarim mutba'im ba'adam. They're not natural, they're not natural and instinctive. Kemo, I'm skipping a line or so. Sheyimtzu kol tnu oseyam hativios, kashena vahayikitsa, hora'a vahasova, vachol shor hatnuos hachakukos b'tiveinu. When a person gets tired, it doesn't require a deliberate, premeditated decision on his part. It's just a natural physical reaction. A person wakes up when he's slept sufficiently. He wakes up naturally. Hunger is something that a person naturally experiences. Our involvement with physicality is instinctive. If I see a food that I like, I don't make a conscious decision to be drawn to that. I naturally want to eat that food. Physical attraction, physical involvement is something that we experience naturally, instinctively. It doesn't require a deliberate decision. The Yetzer HaTov is something that a person doesn't instinctively, it's not that a person is instinctively drawn. If a person is reflective, so then he recognizes and is attracted and wants and will pursue. So the Yetzer Hara functions reflexively. The Yetzer HaTov functions reflectively. And that's the crucial distinction. Again, the Yetzer Hara is something that it's reflexive. The same way, you know, when you know the physical reflexes, you know, the doctor hits you here with a hammer, and so then you have a natural reflex. So we respond again to physical stimuli naturally, instinctively. Spiritual matters require reflection. Ultimately, the Yetzer HaTov is a stronger and more potent force than the Yetzer Hara, and it can channel the Yetzer Hara, but the Yetzer Hara should express itself only in correct and proper ways. But the Yetzer HaTov has to be activated by our thinking and living reflectively. And if a person, again, you know, what we spoke about, the you know, so-called stance of neutrality, if a person will go through life, so then he's just going to be drawn to the Yetzer Hara. Because the Yetzer Hara, that happens naturally. That's what Ramchal says, that the default setting is, if we don't make a concerted effort to live reflectively, so then the default setting is that the subject matter, Mesil Sashorim, Advarim Hanishkochim Mibnei Ha'odam Bateva, a person is naturally going to forget it. These things are going to just be naturally forgotten. They're not instinctive actions or reactions. They're reflective actions. Now, it's certainly true that a person can, through constant reinforcement, you know, develop certain instincts can be developed, and the Yetzer HaTov can be developed in such a way. But we need to understand again this fundamental distinction. You know, sometimes when we're all familiar with phenomenon, you know, when guys are in yeshiva, and there's a framework which very helpfully encourages them and steers them in the right direction. So they're preoccupied with learning, with growth. And then sometimes it happens, you know, hopefully it will never happen again, but sometimes it happens that when at a future stage in life, when a person assumes the responsibility for panosa, making a living, for supporting a family, so then a person just gets so caught up in those preoccupations and occupations, and a person is supposed to make a status for panosa. Not that the person isn't supposed to be involved with that. But if he's involved with that without making this concerted effort to be living reflectively, so then it's just naturally going to happen that he's going to lose his focus on Dvarim Ruchaniyim, that he's not going to be mindful of the aspirations that he had earlier. And at every stage of life, we need to always try to be living reflectively. That's why they tell the story about many Gedolei Olam. It's told about the Chafetz Chaim. It's hard to know when you read stories which ones are true, which ones are not true. But sometimes, even if you don't know whether it's factually true, you know, you can at least judge that it's that it's true on another level. That they used to carve out time for his bodhisattvas. They used to carve out time, just quiet time, to be alone, solitude, to be able to think, to be able to reflect, to be able to take stock. And it's very, very important to, as a way to try to ensure that we don't just lapse into that mode of living where things are nishkachim bateva, as Ramchal describes. And that's one thought. Another thought, in terms of looking for growth, to try to live with depth. So if there's one midah that a person can choose to focus on, you know, whenever you hear that, so obviously, you know, there's at best tremendous oversimplification, and it's not really intended literally. But with that disclaimer, if there's one midah that a person wants to focus on, it's the midah of consistency. And what typifies people who develop their potential is that they're people of remarkable consistency. I think they give a moshel from Chaim Shmulevitz. That Chaim Shmulevitz said, you know, if you, let's say you want to boil some water for a cup of tea. So if you take the tea kettle and you put it on the fire for a minute and you pull it off for a minute, and you put it back on for a minute, and then you pull it back off for a minute, put it back on, pull it back off, then we're going to boil. But you need that constancy and consistency in order to develop. So if there's one midah, it's obviously not, I think for many of us, it's not a midah which comes so naturally and requires an avoda, and requires being mindful of trying to develop. And obviously, we're not going to, you know, on day one, we're not going to be batting anywhere close to 1,000. We're not going to be challenging Ted Williams, who was the last person to hit over 400. We're not going to be challenging him either. But if there's one midah to try to be kona, it's that midah of consistency. And the third thought, and with that I'll conclude. I think maybe the Ramban has this in his Igaris, that he writes to his son that whenever you learn something, when you finish learning, and it doesn't matter whether it was, you know, Gemara, Halacha, Musa, whatever the area of Torah, that a person should always ask himself, is there anything I learned here that I now need to apply? How do I apply Halacha L'maisa? How do I implement what I learned? If I was learning Hilchos and Tilus Yadayim, okay, so what are the halachos now of Tilus Yadayim that I need to be aware of, that I need to be mindful of in washing my hands? If it's a shmooze, so what are the principles that I'm looking to take away and to implement? That whenever a person finishes learning, he should see how he can translate it halacha l'maisa. Okay. I'd count those of the
chance to let you have the boys and then themselves submitted them, ask them, and if anybody else would also like to ask the other questions, maybe you could throw us off and get a bunch.
The Rav was of the opinion that staying in America to do chinuch is of value instead of going back to sell. What would he say, or how does this war and our current situation affect?
So as you correctly referenced, the Rav Zichron Levracha, what was of the opinion that if a person is going to make an impact in Chinuch in Chutz La'aretz and wouldn't make a comparable impact in Eretz Yisrael, or alternately, even if he could make a comparable impact, that maybe in Chutz La'aretz it's a makom she'enish, if the job that he'll do in Chutz La'aretz no one else would do, Masha'en Kein, if he'll come to Eretz Yisrael, so the job he would potentially do, someone else might do, that would warrant staying in Chutz La'aretz. You know, in the hierarchy of Torah values, So nothing equals, you know, transmitting Torah, transmitting Masorah. There's no value that equals that. There are many values within Torah, but in the hierarchy, that's the highest hierarchy. That's the highest within the hierarchy to transmit the Masorah, to have such an impact. How does the war change things? On one level, it doesn't. On one level, it doesn't. On another level, you know, I think European Jewry, even before the war, were already getting very strong messages as to how tenuous their place has become in their respective host countries. You know, those of us living in the US we're operating with more of an illusion, because we weren't necessarily getting those messages. But immediately with the Hamas Yimach Shemam atrocities of Shmini Atzeres, right away those the explosion of such vile anti-Semitism in America certainly drove home for a lot of people that you know, American Jewry's place is also tenuous. If that, you know, will continue to spur Aliyah and the Anglo presence in Eretz Yisrael will then increase, and there will be more need and more opportunities for chinuch here. So then it will increasingly become Efshel L'Kayim Shneim, and it won't be that either or, which for many people, you know, it was, and Adrabah, again, the need will be for a different style of chinuch will become greater here. So on that level, you know, the Mochama will impact the reality, will change the facts on the ground, and therefore can change the calculus for a person who's deliberating. I apologize for the crass marshal, but you know, whenever a person goes shopping, so you know, if I walk into the department store, so I have to know what I'm looking to buy. Otherwise, I'm just gonna get lost and wander around. And to choose a what yeshiva is the best place for someone, a person has to know what it is that he's looking to get from the yeshiva. That doesn't necessarily provide 100% of the answer. A person also has to know himself. You know, a rabbi in a Talmud is a type of a shidduch. The halacha is that the person is allowed to leave Eretz Yisrael to go to Chutzlars to learn Torah. So the Yerushalmi is quoted as and explains what there are no yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael. That's what that halacha is assuming. So it's, no, even when there are yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael, lav mikol adam zocha lilmod. So one variable in making the decision is knowing what a person is looking for, knowing what he's looking for in terms of a level of learning, a darach hachayim, a particular masorah within our general masorah, and the other variable is a person has to know himself. And with those two, so then a person can hope to try to make the right decision.
Okay. For guys in Shadaben in Eretz Yisrael and plan going to YU, if the opportunity arises to stay in Eretz Yisrael, is it better to take the opportunity to stay and not go to YU? And if not, how can one maximize the time in YU while maintaining the desire to return
back to school? Should you stay in Eretz Yisrael as opposed to going back to YU? I guess it depends upon what the opportunity is in Eretz Yisrael, in terms of, you know, what opportunities that opportunity provides. Al Hatzad, that it doesn't provide the opportunities in terms of learning, in terms of growth, in terms of education, that coming to YU. It's kind of related to what we were just talking about. We forget things when we're Maseach Das. If we make a concerted effort not to forget, then we don't forget. So if the connection to Eretz Yisrael that someone has forged during the time here, if a person doesn't pay attention to it once he gets back to Chutz La'aretz, so then it's going to weaken. And he may 3 years later not find himself with such a burning desire to come back. But if he's very conscious of maintaining it, of cultivating it, then b'siyata b'shvaya, he's not going to forget. He's not going to. It's only through Hesach Hadas that it will be frittered. If a person remains focused on it, and a person is reinforcing it. I don't know, does that mean that you have a Seder in Yehuda Halevi in the Kuzari? Does that mean that you join the Aliyah Club? Or does it mean both? Or does it mean, many other possible ways of staying focused and keeping the flame burning? But the main thing is not to be Maseach Das. So I can try, Leonard Rez Hashem, to talk a little bit about YU. I can't engage in comparisons, so I'm not talking about any other place. I'm not describing what any other place is or isn't. I'll describe Leonard Rez Hashem a little bit what I've come to know firsthand over the past decades, but I can't. I'm not engaging in comparisons. A life of Avodas Hashem, on the one hand, is there's single-mindedness. That it's very easy. That life is only about one thing, and that's about Ma Hashem Lekecha Shel Meimach. That's all life is about. There's no life. What's life about? To know Ma Hashem Elokecha Shel Meimach and to do it. There's a single-mindedness. Well, Lamaisa, we know from the Torah that what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants from us, though, encompasses many different things. And what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants from us is to balance many different practical commitments. There's only one axiological commitment, which is to do Ritzon Hashem. But Ritzon Hashem translates in different contexts, at different times, in different occasions. It translates, it guides us, it instructs us in different ways. So Ritzon Hashem tells us that Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam. But Ritzon Hashem also tells us that a person is supposed to make kishtavos for panosa, that a Baruch Hu created a natural world, a world that functions according to Chukei HaTeva, and requires us to live on that level, that all betochen notwithstanding, a person is supposed to live on that natural level. So a person has to be able to strike a balance between that commitment to Talmud Torah and making hishtavos for panosa. that the another area of balance that is needed in Avodas Hashem is how we interact with the outside world. And interact doesn't just mean sort of personal interactions between Jews and non-Jews, although that is part of it also, but interact, you know, even intellectually and culturally with the outside world. What we accept and welcome from the outside world and what we reject and what we spurn from the outside world. And clearly, you know, it's not an all or nothing. It's not that someone is supposed to accept everything. That obviously isn't the case. But it's also not the case that a person is not supposed to accept anything. You know, just to illustrate, it says in Shulchan Aruch that when you have a shaylin halacha which requires medical input, so, you know, if the doctor who's expert is not Jewish, so then we look to him for his medical input. Again, the Rav has to process it. And ultimately, the Rav will decide whether or not the chola needs to eat a Yom Kippur or not. But the input will come from... So to find the balance between what one filters out and what one lets in from the outside world is another area in which there needs to be balance in living a life of Torah. That's certainly one of the values that you know that YU traditionally has sought to transmit to its Talmidim. Another value, which is so crucial and so vital, is that Torah should never ever be politicized. That a person's stature in Torah should be measured by his greatness in Torah, his Yiras Shamayim, his humility, you know, whether or not his views accord with the derech that one follows, you know, in terms of so many of the issues that differentiate different drachim Avodas Hashem. So one should recognize and have the appropriate respect for, you know, genuine Gedolei Yisrael, whether they're the Morei Derech of our community or not. Torah should never be politicized. You know, in Rav Shechter's Shiurim, so you hear, he quotes the full range of Gedolei Yisrael. He'll quote from Rav Kook, he'll quote from Menuchas Alasa. Obviously, they had very different opinions on lots of things. But they were both very great people. They were both Gedolei Yisrael, and the fact that halacha l'maisa one is going to live within a particular path within Torah, but Torah is not supposed to be politicized in the sense of not acknowledging, respecting, and even learning from, you know, those who are not necessarily our primary Morei Derech. It's another, I think, core value of the yeshiva. In some of the drushes that Rav Soloveitchik delivered before Mizrahi, which were then some of them were then gathered and was first it was called the four drushes, then they added another one, it was called the Chomish drushes. So he speaks of rhetorically a 14th animamin. Again, it was rhetorical, obviously. The 14th animamin is that the Torah can be completely followed, implemented, regardless of what historical epoch a person lives in, regardless of what the historical metzias of his day is. Now, the reason that's rhetorical is obviously that's part of the eighth animamin of the eternity of Torah, and eighth and ninth Torah min haShemayim and Zos HaTorah Lo Sahim Uklefes. The way to do that is not to change Torah, but to recognize that sometimes, you know, as historical circumstances change, so the Torah's directive changes. You know, maybe in Eastern Europe, it would have been considered a pirzah at a certain point to teach Torah in a language other than Yiddish. But at a certain point, that obviously no longer became the case. And sort of recognizing what tactical, not substantive, never ever substantive changes, but whatever tactical changes are needed, you know, to respond to modernity. You know, one of the ideas that the Rav talks about there is that the need for advanced secular education is that realistically, Jews are not all going to be electricians and plumbers or businessmen who they're going to go into fields that require advanced education. And if one doesn't show how that can be done with maintaining a full commitment to the Yahadus, if one doesn't show how that can be done while still aspiring to be a Ben Torah, to be a Talmud Chacham, so then you're just pointing people on a path of assimilation. So that principle of recognizing how to meet, tactically, how to meet the challenges of modernity, not how to change Rachmana Litzlan substance, but tactically how to meet the challenges of the era in which one lives, and not just sort of literally imitating, you know, the tactics and reproducing tactics from 150 or 200 years ago when it was a different metzias. Once upon a time, in Eastern Europe, yeshivas, they didn't teach diktuk. So someone once asked the Chafetz Chaim, you know, it says in Gemara Brachos that kol hakor kriyishma umedaktek, so mitzana lel gehenim. If Rachmana Litzlan, the person has to go to gehenim, if he said kriyishma, and he was medaktek in kriyishma, he knew ashvanach and ashvanach, and then he pronounced and he articulated the kriyishma properly, so then mitzana lel gehenim, they turned the temperature down. So why don't you, in Radin or in the other yeshivas, why don't you teach diktuk? So the Chofetz Chaim answered, he said, you're right, he says, but what's the din b'di'evit? He says, the din b'di'evit is karvel o diktek is yotze. If you say kriyashma, but you don't know the difference between a shvana and a shvanach, you yotze. But diktek velo kara is not yotze. But if you know the diktuk, but you don't say kriyashma, then you're not yotze. So once upon a time, what that comment from the Chofetz Chaim reflected is that when Haskalah began, so one of the ploys they used to try to make inroads into the film community was with things like diktuk. So because of that, it became off limits. But that's not true anymore. That's not the battle over assimilation is not going to be lost by knowing the difference between a shvana and a shvanach anymore. I don't know anyone who has any problems in the Buddha because they discovered the difference between a shvanach and a shvanach. So to recognize, again, you know, what tactics were just those and you know, appropriate for a particular historical era, and then now we're different. The same thing is when it comes to Chinuch Habonos. Chinuch Habonos also. So these all, I think, are some of the elements of the Masorah that we try to transmit.
How does Rebbe think we could open a dialogue with people who may not, of different hashkafas, that may not recognize your gedolim that you hold in a high esteem?
Depends whether there's any openness. Depends whether there's any interest. If there's no openness, then you're not going to. There's such a thing, Chazal tells us in Gemara Yavam, there's such a thing as a Dava Nishma and a Dava Shena Nishma. And you know, if there's an openness, so then it's not so difficult. And if there's no openness, it's impossible. Doesn't matter what you'll do. I think I once heard quoted that the Bali Musa say, "Bram hayotzim and alev nachnasim alev." What does it mean? It's not always true. Sometimes a person can very sincerely say something and it doesn't go anywhere. So I think the Bali Musa say, no, if two hearts are attuned, so then advam hayotzim and alev nachnasim alev. But if I'm not open to what you have to say, it doesn't matter how sincere you are, it doesn't matter how effective and compelling your presentation is. If I'm not really interested, I'm not really open in hearing what you have to say, I'm not going to hear. So it depends on whether or not that receptivity, that interest, that openness is there.
Could I be given maybe just some criteria or how to know how we should define who is a gadol? There are certain comments and things that are being said publicly. People hear from figures that people claim who's a gadol. Those comments can be either hurtful or seem very off-base attitude in certain times. It would be helpful how should a person figure out or people we should consider those or not.
So the easier part of the answer and of the trying to figure that out is, you know, there are certain behavioral markers Chaim Volozhinik comments in Ruach Chaim, and he didn't write it, but it's the notes of his Shirim and Pirkei Avos that on the first Mishnah, Moshe Kibbutz Torah Sinai, Masali Yeshua, Yeshua's Kenim, Kenim and Neviim, that each of those links in the Masara are identified and defined by their extraordinary humility. And he quotes Pesukim for it, you know, beginning with the passing of Ish Moshe Anav Ma'od. And that has remained, you know, a hallmark of Gedolei Yisrael. So that, you know, that's sort of a behavioral marker, as is, you know, the you know, integrity in terms of behavior. Those are behavioral markers. The more difficult thing for us in our ignorance to assess is, you know, the understanding of Torah, which is a sine qua non for Gedolei Yisrael. So the more we know, the better a chance we have at trying to understand that. They used to be, I think they went out of business a while ago, so your Rebbeim will know, but I don't think you know. They used to, you know, YU has a Cy Sims School of Business. So Cy Sims founded, he had a department store called Sims. And their advertisement was that an educated consumer is our best customer. Because what they used to do is when those who would let's say with men's apparel, those who would manufacture suits. So at the end of the year, next year they wanted to roll out a new style suit, so that they needed to get rid of this year's merchandise. So what all the fancy suit brands hadn't been able to sell. So at the end of the year, they would sell to Sims, heavily discounted, and then Sims then sold, you know, suits, which were top of the line, but if they were, you know, 1 year old, so you got it at a very significant discount. But in order to appreciate what they were giving you, so you had to be a maiden, you had to know suits. And the more you understood about what a quality suit was, then the more you appreciated what you were buying from them. So that was their advertising. That was their line. An educated consumer is our best customer. So being an educated hedyot, you know, the more educated we are as hedyotas, so the better positioned we are to try to, you know, recognize gedolim. Even so, obviously, it remains a challenge. But one thing that we're looking for on that level is, you know, Torah consists of an awful lot of details, an awful lot of se'ifim in Shulchan Aruch, because Torah guides every facet of our lives. So Torah is very detailed, and there are lots of minutiae in halacha. But then there are also overarching principles in Torah, and clearly. There can't be godless in Torah, regardless of how encyclopedic one's knowledge of the minutiae is. There can't be godless in Torah without that understanding of the sodos of Torah. You know, we spoke before about how HaKadosh Baruch Hu created a natural world, and it's axiomatic to halacha that we're required to live all chiyuvei bitacha notwithstanding. It's axiomatic in halacha. It's one of the pillars on which halacha is built. It's also individual halachas, but it's more than an individual detail in halacha. It's a pillar upon which halacha rests, is that we're obligated to live on that natural level. And for instance, so that's what the Yerushalmi says, that if a person sees a situation of pikuach nefesh, and he goes to the Rav to ask a shayla about, should I be mechal shabbos, shouldn't I be mechal shabbos, harezah shofar dam. Why is it harezah shofar dam? Because we live in a natural world. In a natural world, if a person's having a heart attack, and instead of driving him to the hospital right away, a person stops to call his Rav and find out, should I do this, shouldn't I do that? So those few minutes can make the difference between life and death. We live in a natural world. The Ramban writes at the beginning of Parshas Vayishlach that the reason the Torah records Parshas Vayishlach is to teach us how Yaakov, in his impending encounter with Esav, so the Ramban begins, he says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu saved Yaakov Avinu, and then within the same breath, the Ramban says, but Yaakov Avinu will botach b'tzidkaso, v'hishtadel b'chol yecholto. He prepared himself to engage in milchama with Esav. Because, yes, we believe that ultimately HaKadosh Baruch Hu will determine things, but part of what HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes into account is whether or not we're doing what we're supposed to be doing, what we're obligated to be doing on the natural level. Ramban repeats that again in Parashat Shofar. He says that kiseitzel amulcham alo yevecha, and you have to go to war. And you'll see an overpowering force. Lo sira mehem ki Hashem alokecha imach amalcham eretz Mitzrayim. Don't be afraid, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is with you. And then so who's going to win? Who's going to fight the war first? HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And then it says ufok du sari tzvaos barosh am. Then it says you have to appoint military commanders. What are you appointing military commanders? No, because haTorah tetzave b'derech eretz. The Torah says that Ritzon Hashem is HaKadosh Baruch Hu But it's Baruch Hu doesn't like to perform open miracles. He doesn't like to perform supernatural feats. And because of that, he requires that we act on a natural level. And because of that, there's cause and effect, and there are consequences to what we do and don't do on a natural level also. So those are yesodos of Torah. If a person only knows the yesod of betachon but doesn't know this, if a person only knows this but doesn't know the yesod of betachon, so that kind of skewing of yesodos of Torah is not consistent with godless. Godless is not only knowing, you know, every all the seifim, all the minutiae. It's especially knowing also the yesodos of all of Torah.
How does one create a healthy relationship with the Baruch Hashem in the world of today's day?
You know that there's a tendency that we naturally have to define moderation in relation to those around us, to the world around us. And to have a healthy and correctly proportioned relationship to Olam Hagashmi, at least in America, one has to resist that tendency of sort of defining ourselves and moderation by looking around us. You know, there's so much. You know, there are people who struggle, but there's also so much affluence. And the assumption of what's needed as opposed to being a luxury or a comfort or an indulgence has just become so inflated that we have to be careful. You know, we have to look in the Rambam, Hilchos Deos, not just for knowing that we need to be moderate, but to know what moderation is, and not to define that in a relationship to the world around us. The world around us is obsessed with Olam Hazeh and Tanuge Olam Hazeh, and one can be moderate in relation to the world around us and still be way, way out of sync.
Are there any consistent or constant issues, concerns that we see in the post of dating and marriage that I think people should be aware of, or things that should be done to be worked on already now?
The I think one can, without, you know, too much oversimplification, reduce things to just a few salient points. You know, dating certainly provides a context and a framework to see if two people enjoy spending time together, and obviously that is of value, and is definitely you know, a box, you know, that people should be looking to check off. But it shouldn't be mistaken for, you know, you can, I don't know, I think we all know, let's say from our friendships, there are people that we enjoy spending time with, but we don't necessarily have so much respect for them. We don't necessarily, they can be fun people, but we don't necessarily look up to them. We don't necessarily have that much respect for them. We don't necessarily want them to be a formative influence on our children. And while that is a value, it shouldn't eclipse, you know, the value of, you know, when a young man is getting married. So, you know, he wants that, you know, not only should he, you know, be able to have a sense of companionship and enjoy spending time with his wife, but he wants that his wife should be, you know, someone that he wants to be a formative influence on his children, that can be a role model for the children, and need to, you know, recognize the primacy of that, not to the exclusion of the you know, of the of that companionship.
Trying to find out what this career path should look like, how people have trodden down that path. The era of AI, I was curious to hear Rebbe's thoughts, as I know personally, I know many friends, one such example was the members of that, Rebbe Shear, 13 years ago, brilliant individual who's training to finish his PhD as a chemist, and has just discovered that the past 6 years of effort on his part can be reduced easily by AI. And for many people looking Shtablus, therefore, now in the future, is trying to understand not, okay, so I have this path and this path, and I have to consider how to juggle everything, as much as many industries, at least perspective of many, that many industries are on the precipice of being completely overturned by AI. So when facing the unknown in terms of Shtablus, almost like other eras in Jewish history where there was a massive change which was about to befall people, what degree does one invest in the conventional wisdom of, okay, so like this has always been around, this will continue to be around, when there's a very good chance, I don't know exactly how high, that it can be replaced by something we haven't quite seen. At what point then does one, I don't want to give up, or just shift gears and just kind of wait or pursue something which, you know, we're still going to need food or other such.
You know, in other areas, I pretend to be competent. When it comes to talking about AI, I can't even pull that off. I can't even pretend to be competent. But I don't mean with the comparison I'm about to give, I don't mean to compare necessarily in terms of degree. But you know, at various junctures in history, there have been revolutions that totally changed the way people make a living. You know, whether it was the Industrial Revolution, you know, is certainly, and you know, the movement to living in cities as opposed to out in the country. And you know, as the definition of hishtadlus is that it makes sense. It's that it's very cogent on the natural level. Again, we don't believe in kochivot zemiyadi, but the definition of hishtadlus again is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, if this is a natural world, I'm going to channel things naturally, which means that I'm only going to channel things if you function and make your effort on the natural level. So I think as much as possible. Again, whatever unknowns remain, notwithstanding, but as much as possible, you know, a person has to try to anticipate, you know, what the implications are going to be. Like, certainly some fields are not going to be affected, right? All the fields of, you know, sort of Ben Odom Lachavero, you know, whether it's teaching or people who do therapy or something. There's no, you can't, yes, you can have a computer teach math. You can have a computer teach math. But, you know, one of the lessons of COVID and education on Zoom was, you know, maybe in theory it works, but in practice it doesn't work. So it's hard to see. I'm not saying that the field of education isn't affected, but it's not going to be displaced. It's not going to be shut down. And the same thing in terms of, you know, therapists, whether it's psychologists, whether it's social workers. You know, people are not going to get what they need from talking to a computer program and a computer program. It isn't going to happen. It isn't going to happen. The creativity which sparks new businesses, which sparks entrepreneurship, computers are not creative. I mean, they can have tremendous ideas, but I don't think the definition, they only have what you put in them. So, you know, those kinds of things presumably are, you know, can't and won't be shut down. Will some jobs be eliminated? I'm sure they will. You know, there used to be toll collectors on bridges, and there are no more toll collectors on bridges. Remember my friend Zochon Levochon once telling me that when they first came out with machine matzahs, so that there were two possible objections. Some held, you know, that when you make a machine nuts, it's not the shmo, because you're just pressing the button on the machine. You're not kneading it with your hands, etc. And the other one wasn't objecting based on the shmo, but they were worried about all the people who earned their living from baking the nuts, how they would... So there certainly will be jobs and fields very much impacted, but I think... to a certain degree, we can prognosticate, and that's all hishtadlus requires of us. Is the bar of hishtadlus is to do what we can on a natural level, you know, and whatever is impossible to foresee on a natural level, you know, ain't done an efshem mishiyash.
The Rav famously supported and taught women Gemara. How has that ideology changed over time in our world?
Chazal unequivocally say that the father should not take the initiative with his daughter in teaching a Torah, and that's especially true in terms of Torah Shabbat. So that's something unequivocal. It's Machlokes Tanoim, but in terms of how we pass it. Me'idach Gisa, it's also as abundantly clear that what one is supposed to transmit Yahadus, you know, to women, that women should be, you know, deeply rooted in our Masorah and should be Ovdei Hashem as well. And there was a recognition amongst the many, many Gedolei Yisrael that they didn't agree on necessarily on the details, on the particulars, the curricular particulars, that required teaching Torah Shabbat Pet, not as an ace lassos going against the Gemara and Sota, but the Gemara and Sota is talking about it as theoretical knowledge. And this is a question of transmitting emunah. One has to constantly, every generation has to assess and reassess how the challenges of chinuch habanos in their generation are best met. It's not necessarily going to be the answer the same for every community. That's why we can't, you know, only quote the Chafetz Chaim L'Kut HaLacha, so only quote the Rav. Again, those Maaseh Rav certainly remain of vital importance in terms of the Yesod that you have to meet the challenges of the generation. But how you meet those challenges depends upon that generation. And we learn from experience of the past 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. So one can't just, you know, slavishly transpose, because it's, you know, ultimately you're dealing with responding to today's mitzvahs, which isn't necessarily identical with yesterday's mitzvahs. Or if it is, that itself requires a judgment of, you know, the chachamim who are alive today.
How much should the Moreno Ruchim be studied in the Rambam, post Rambam era? There were many advancements in Kabbalah, which he wasn't necessarily aware of, or modern philosophy.
There's nothing dated or outdated in the Rambam other than some scientific facts in terms of, you know, say, the cosmogony. Beyond that, and even there, what the Rambam is sort of seeing in them may be true for modern cosmogony as well. That's a different shmuz. But beyond that, there's nothing outdated in anything that I've ever wrote. Well, whether, you know, there are other concerns as to, you know, whether one should or shouldn't study Maran Ruchim, you know. But being outdated is not the concern. We solved all the world's problems without a union, we can break.
Either way, everyone, maybe give Rebbe some time before I know he has to share very shortly, and the next room over for the phone. Thank you very much for sharing.
Okay, thank you.